Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is Vincent Wall with you on News Talk's Taking Stock. We're joined now by Peter Spiegel, the US Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Peter, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Good to be back, Vincent.
Now, we're going to discuss Joe Biden's almost first 100 days in office coming up later this month, Peter. Could I put to you two quotes that I saw attributed about him to you, just to get our conversation going? One is by Diane Julius, a British-based economist fellow at Chatham House. And she writes that Joe Biden is proving to be both bold in his fiscal ambitions and brave in his choice of battles. Well, on the other hand, the right-wing Republican politician Ted Cruz, no lover of Joe, says Biden's radical nature has been blurred by his dullness. But both friend and foe seem to be recognizing that this man has a radical program and he's trying to push it through pretty quickly.
Interesting. I think probably you're right that both of them are focusing on the same thing. I guess my view is slightly a little bit more nuanced, because I do not think we have a track record for Joe Biden stretching back to the 1970s. Joe Biden is no radical. I mean, this is the man who is sort of an old pro-union labor guy from Delaware. I mean, he hasn't suddenly in his 77th, 78th year changed his stripes. What he's facing is political reality, which is he's got 50 votes in the Senate, which means he has to basically thread the needle and make sure he gets the entire Democratic caucus in the Senate on board. And that means, in some cases, kowtowing to the left wing of the party, which is in some ways ascendant now on Capitol Hill. So the need to go to $1.9 trillion in the stimulus bill, which is probably, you know, depending on who you talk to, maybe a trillion too much. Larry Summers, for instance, the former Democratic Secretary of the Treasury, has argued this. That partially was political. He needed to make sure he was bringing the left-wing Democratic Party on board. And I think you're seeing that as well with his next big initiative, which is this infrastructure initiative, which, again, has some traditional moderate elements to it, you know, roads and bridges and tunnels and that kind of stuff. But it also includes a lot of electrification of the auto network so that cars can be plugged in, some green elements to it, some SOPs to social programs and whatnot. So I don't think that we're seeing a radical Joe Biden suddenly emerge as president of the United States. I think we're seeing a Joe Biden who is a consummate politician, and I mean that in the best way, you know, feels in his veins the way Washington works and the need to thread that needle to keep all Democrats in the House, where he has a very narrow majority, and in the Senate, where he has the narrowest of majority, literally a one vote majority when the vice president is called in to vote on a tie. And I think that's more what we're seeing here. I think we're seeing a political reality rather than an ideological shift.
He may not be radical in person, Peter, and I take that point absolutely, but just the sheer scale, if he were to get all these stimulus bills through, and he's got his $1.9 trillion package through already, if he was to get them all through, it would be close to $5 trillion, which, despite all the quantitative easing we've become accustomed to over recent years, would equate to about 25% of US annual GDP. Is that not radical in its own right, the sheer scale of it?
Oh sure. But let's divide this up a little bit though. The 1.9 trillion in the stimulus bill that has already passed, that's a big number, and that's got a lot of people nervous, frankly, on the markets in particular, that we could be seeing the beginnings of sort of a push towards inflation. The headline number on the infrastructure bill is a little bit misleading. That is a 10-year infrastructure bill. So, you know, the top line number is not something that suddenly is going to flush into the U.S. economy overnight. So I think that's slightly misleading. And the rest of it that you've added up there is sort of your annual budget discretionary spending, which, again, is higher than proposed under Trump. But again, this is part of the normal budgetary process. But look, I'm not disagreeing necessarily with your premise. What the policies he has proposed are much more leftist, for lack of a better word, than traditional Joe Biden policies or even the Obama administration. I guess my answer to both the quotes you came with, particularly the Ted Cruz quote, is I do not think we're suddenly seeing a wolf in sheep clothing, that he was always a radical, that he was just waiting to become president. I think this is a politician who has a keen political instinct, and he is acting on his instincts. And the lay of the land right now in Washington is such that he needs to keep the party united, and he's getting no Republican support, even from the moderates. So he needs to keep that base on board. And that's why we're seeing policies that may be more to the left than a traditional Joe Biden that we've come to know and love, you know, over the last 50 years.
he's keeping his left wing in place, as you say. Is there some element, do you think, as well, Peter, in that, in putting these very high numbers? And I appreciate what you say, that some of it is spending over a 10-year period, but that in putting these high numbers out there, he knows he's going to have to compromise along the way, and that the numbers may come down.
Yeah, on the infrastructure bill in particular, and he signaled that already, right? He has said, you know, particularly on the corporate tax rate, for instance, which he's proposing to go up to 27-28%, he's already said that he's willing to negotiate on that. The number itself may be open for negotiation as well. So I think you're right on that one, and frankly, we'll have to negotiate with his own party, because you have some of the more moderate members, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, Kristen Sinema from Arizona, who've already signaled they're uncomfortable with the tax increases and some of the spending elements. But there is certainly a assumption within the White House, led by Ron Klain, who is the chief of staff, that one of the political failings of the Obama administration is that they didn't go big enough and they didn't beat their chest loud enough politically. That aside from the economic arguments of maybe overstimulation and the headline number being too big, that what Obama did in the wake of the financial crisis was too small, too moderate, too willing to negotiate and play ball with the Republicans and give in to the Republican needs, that this should be a louder, you know, bigger and chest beating kind of package, because then that's what they feel will win them continued majorities in the House and Senate in the midterm elections, which again are only 18 months away at this point. So, you know, that's there is a political calculus here in the White House as well, that these big headline numbers send the signal to a lot of those people who were Trump voters, right? It's the working class white voters, that the government's here, they're coming to your rescue, they're building bridges, they're building roads, they're providing you stimulus checks, and that is a powerful political message that this White House thinks they failed to make 10 years ago when Barack Obama was president.
And we haven't heard a lot from former President Trump himself, at least not on this side of the Atlantic, Peter. Have there been any polls or any responses from Trump supporters as to what they think of Biden now?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the polls we've seen, his approval numbers are pretty high in the mid-50s. There is a significant number of Republicans who have given him popularity in terms of approval ratings. The more interesting thing, though, is when you talk about the policies, the stimulus bill was very, very popular amongst Republican voters. The infrastructure bill has proven popular amongst Republican voters, too. And so what you hear from the White House is, you know, there's a lot of criticism. Hey, you said you were going to govern as a conciliator. You're going to be bipartisan. And the White House response is, being bipartisan doesn't mean you have to work with Republicans in Washington. It's very clear to us that Republicans in the country back these policies. So we have seen a groundswell is the wrong word, but certainly a willingness of traditional Republican voters in the countryside to support what are viewed as pro blue collar policies. Now, Trump himself, as you say, partially because he's been banned from Twitter, but has been relatively quiet, but he's still quietly really putting a lot of muscle and influence, putting a lot of influence into the Republican Party right now. There was just a couple of weeks ago, there was a gathering in Palm Beach, and some had to sort of show up in Mar-a-Lago to hear him speak. He's been threatening and has in some cases backed Republican congressional candidates in primaries. So he is in the process of reorganizing his political operation and raising money. So I don't think we've heard the last of Donald Trump, and Republicans are frankly a little bit perplexed about how to deal with him. There are a lot of sort of traditional pro-business Republicans who really would like to see the party go back to free trade and low taxes and sort of the more traditional Republican priorities. But they are frankly a little bit afraid still about this Trump base and what Trump can do with it. And so I don't think we've heard the last of Donald Trump, even if he can't get access to Twitter.
Yeah, there's a huge elements of social policy investment within these plans, which, you know, from education to childcare to Medicare, promoting job creation in socially disadvantaged areas, all of which are not only good in their own right, but play to the Democratic agenda within the states and federally. The only serious pushback we've seen has been from the business community to the proposal to increase corporate taxes to a headline level of 28% from 21%. Is it the case that there's unlikely to be too much pushback from middle America, blue or red, as long as he doesn't increase taxes on them?
Well, it'll be interesting to watch, because there has been an assumption in American politics for, frankly, most of the post-war period that, look, we're not Europe. We do the average American does not support government intervention to the extent that we see in the social safety net in Ireland or elsewhere in Europe. That is just something that's sort of something un-American about it, and that Republicans could cry socialism and really win over American voters on this stuff. As you are 100% right that a lot of what was in the stimulus bill and a lot of what's in this new infrastructure package is, for lack of a better word, more European-style social democrat than a traditional American democratic politics. And thus far, we haven't heard a huge peep out of the American people on this. Now, part of that is because the Republican Party is incredibly disorganized right now. They're infighting over, the post-Trump world. We've had a scandal here involving a pro-Trump congressman who's vaguely accused of hiring prostitutes and this kind of stuff. And it's become a very internecine debate right now. And as a result, the party itself has been unable to sort of counter Biden, either rhetorically or politically or pedagogically. So there may be yet a pushback from the American people on the scare word of socialism. But, on the other hand, there may be a ideological shift going on due to the pandemic, due to whatever Trumpism revealed about the American public. There may be a more willingness on the part of your average American these days. And certainly that's the case, I think, for younger Americans now, who have much like sort of almost the Corbynistas in Britain, have embraced a Bernie Sanders, have embraced Elizabeth Warren. There is a political shift going on in which, government intervention in the economy and in society more broadly is more acceptable now to American voters. I think that will be put to the test once the Republican Party sort of gets its act together and can start making more coherent arguments against Bidenism, whatever that means. But it is you put your finger on a very, very interesting trend here, and it is something that we're watching very closely at the Financial Times, because clearly it's something the business community is concerned about. I think just the one other bit of your question about we have heard pushback from a lot of the big lobbying groups that represent businesses, as you say, on the corporate tax rate. There is some skepticism about how ardent they are about this and whether this is a negotiation tactic. Look, if any president of the United States comes out and says, I'm going to raise corporate taxes, you wouldn't expect corporations to their first response to be, we love this. But there is an acknowledgement amongst most companies and executives we talk to that 21% is much lower than even they wanted, that 28% is a pretty reasonable level. That's still below what Barack Obama level corporate taxes were. And there is also acknowledgement that there needs to be infrastructure spending in the U.S. because we've been without it for so long. Again, crumbling infrastructure is not something that's unique to the United States. I lived in Europe for 10 years, and they're going through that in Germany in particular. But, so there is a belief within most responsible corporate managers that there is a need for infrastructure spending, and I think they're willing to see the corporate tax rate to go up. So, yes, there has been some pushback with the business community, but I think, in my view, and a lot of people I've talked to, this is a bit of a negotiating position from most of the corporates. We've also heard people like Jeff Bezos who've come out and actually supported the president on this. So I think you're going to see a much more give and take between the White House and the major corporate interests over that kind of issue.
Our guest here on News Talk is Peter Spiegel, the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times. He may not be radical, and I'll let you win that argument absolutely, Peter. But in terms of his foreign policy in the first 3 months or so, he has been very strong and clear, hasn't he? He has tried to restate America's position as the leader of the Western world, if not of the globe, in terms of giving support back to the U.S. institutions that have defined the world since the Second World War, the IMF, the UN, pushing the global green agenda across the globe, basically, as of this week, upping the ratchet with Russia in terms of alleged espionage, certainly taking a very hard line with China, and also that whole America First policy of not as aggressive as Trump and not as partisan as Trump, but basically looking to see what America needs to do in itself in terms of its supply lines, in terms of its essential products, and being prepared to use trade policy to that effect.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right on this, but I would argue that this is not a new Joe Biden. I think in many ways, when you look at foreign policy, people expected, Obama's third term. And I covered the White House, back in my former life on foreign policy. And I was there for the early days of the Obama-Biden administration. And what was very apparent to me is that Barack Obama and Joe Biden had very different views when it came to foreign policy. Joe Biden comes from a much more traditional sort of Dean Acheson wing of the Democratic Party. I like to call it the liberal internationalist. This is kind of what the foreign policy people talk about. And there was a view that, you know, it's this American is this exceptional country that needs to project its values, democracy, human rights. And that's part of what American foreign policy should be about. And that is something that Joe Biden has always taken very seriously, that, you know, defending the rights of minorities, you know, very anti-Russian on this kind of issue, defending the right of democracy, again, very anti-China on this regard. Barack Obama was a very different character. Barack Obama was much more traditional, almost Kissingerian in that respect. He felt there were American interests, and he believed American power should be used to promote those interests. But getting involved in things like human rights and democracy promotion, that was neocons. That was George W. Bush, right? Remember during the Green Revolution in Iran, the U.S. did nothing. There was a move toward democratic reform inside Iran, and Barack Obama said it is more important for us to pursue a nuclear deal with Iran than to support democratic change in Iran. And I know the Biden people were very, very opposed to that. Tony Blinken in particular, who was Biden's national security advisor at the time. Flash forward to Joe Biden as president of the United States, and exactly as you say, he's been much more aggressive on China, on Hong Kong, on the Uyghurs, the Muslim minorities in China. He's called it genocide. You know, he has taken on China less on the economic and trade front and more on the human rights and democracy promotion front. He has done the same elsewhere in the world. You know, you've seen him be much more aggressive with, as you mentioned, on Ukraine today. Even he's issued more sanctions against Russia because of, you know, again, suppression of democracy within Russia, the attack on the U.S. election site, but also on the oppression their intervention in Ukraine, where again he stands very much with allies and for democracy promotion. So I think what you're seeing, and let's not forget the other big issue for the week has been Afghanistan. This is something where he broke very, very strongly with Barack Obama during the review early in his administration. Obama went along with the generals, went with a surge in Afghanistan, you know, use of American force to bring about, I don't know, social change or pacification, depending on your term for it, and he has now defied his generals and said, I want them out. Again, this is not a new Joe Biden. This is a Joe Biden we've known for 10 years. He has always been opposed to expanding the footprint in Afghanistan. And he has the political experience in Washington, having been, you know, former chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate, you know, decades of getting to know global leaders. He can stand up to the generals in the way that his two predecessors, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, could not, because they didn't have that experience, didn't have that sort of insider Washington knowledge. So I guess it's a long way of saying I agree with you 100%. He's put forward a foreign policy that's very different from both Donald Trump, but also Barack Obama. But again, I don't think this is something we should be surprised about. This is something that Joe Biden has talked a lot about and stood for over the last, you know, 10, 20 years since he's been very prominent on foreign policy as a politician.
So let's not call him Radical Joe. Let's call him Consistent Joe and Persistent Joe. Do you think he can also be Lucky Joe, that despite the very tight arithmetic in Congress and the compromises he's inevitably going to have to make, that the vaccine program is rolling out pretty well as far as we can see? The economic data is improving by the week in terms of employment numbers, in terms of retail sales, consumer confidence, and that buoyant and recovering economy and recovering public health situation can basically buoy him up and his policies up, get through the midterm elections and perhaps establish a 4 to 8 year program cycle.
Look, I'm very reluctant to predict that, because I've seen too many first 100 days of, you know, I first arrived in Washington when Bill Clinton's first 100 days. And what I just recall is every first 100 days seemed to go pretty well. Donald Trump may be an exception, but Donald Trump is an exception to everything. And everyone is talking about, gosh, isn't this amazing? You do have this honeymoon period, I think, for almost any president where, you know, you've just won an election, a nationwide election. The people are behind you. The media is excited about something new to cover. And you use that first 100 days to really get your agenda across. But I just talked to a pretty strong Republican critic of him the day before yesterday, who readily acknowledged he's played a very bad hand very well. Right. He does not have the majority in the Senate and the House that a Barack Obama had, you know, coming in. And yet he's gotten some very substantive things through Congress. It's been popular. And as you say, the rest of the rising tide is in his way. We are, you know, I just got my second vaccine 2 days ago. So the only benefit of turning 50 this year was getting qualifying for a second vaccine in New York. So I'm very excited about that. And as you say, the data out today, you know, the lowest number of jobless claims since the pandemic started, retail sales are the jump was the biggest, only the second biggest ever. And so suddenly you're feeling like actually he's got the wind in his back. So look, he could very well be Lucky Joe. And again, that is something that Barack Obama did not have, right? He inherited the financial crisis, had to spend, you know, the first year of his presidency basically repairing the financial crisis, which is not, was not high on his agenda when he ran for president. But Biden has been able to sort of get a lot of his policy priorities passed through stimulus and now in this infrastructure bill that he may not have been able to do beforehand because of circumstances. And again, you know, when you talk about to them off the record, a lot of Biden people will acknowledge that Operation Warp Speed, which is a Trump era vaccine program, did a lot of good and they are benefiting from them. Now, they have done a much better job than anyone in the Trump White House at actually delivering, because a delivery of vaccine was a total mess before Jeff Zients, who's now the coronavirus czar in the White House, came onto the scene. So the Biden administration gets a lot of credit, but they are in some ways on the both on the economics and on the pandemic, inheriting a directionality that started under Trump. And I think you're right in that respect, that he is in many ways Lucky Joe.
And is that one key to his possible success, Peter? A competent cabinet, a competent people that he's put around him?
Well, you know, it is funny because, you know, the U.S. government, you know, used to have a reputation for competence. You know, the classic thing was the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. This was the gold standard. And under you know, a year of Donald Trump, it has been totally denigrated and distrusted now. The fact that they are able to do things competently now may bring Biden a bit of a glow going into the midterms. The reason I'm slightly skeptical about this and nervous to make a prediction is every first term midterm election of every president out there, even popular presidents, the president's party loses seats. And so I'm very reluctant to predict that this will turn things in Biden's favor, and that a lot of these districts that went for the Republicans in 2020 will flip back to the Democrats in 2022, because they just, you know, if passes prologue, this just doesn't happen. In the Senate, there is potentially more opportunity there because there are more vulnerable Republican seats. A lot of Republicans are retiring, so I guess there is more of a chance there. But again, history teaches us that it is incredibly difficult for the president's party to gain seats in the first midterm election. So everything seems to be going well right now for him. The wind's at his back. You know, I am hoping, planning on going on an actual flight in the coming weeks because I am now duly vaccinated. But I do think there is still political reality here. And political reality is it's very, very difficult for a sitting president to see gains in midterm congressional elections. So I, having spent, you know, most of my career in political Washington, I'm reluctant to sort of go against that trend.
There's the wonderful value of all that political reporting experience, Peter, and you're only 50 years of age. That's Peter Spiegel, the U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Great to be back.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.